From the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. There's a great new book on my baseball bookshelf. It's called The Best Team Money Can Buy, The Los Angeles Dodgers' Wild Struggle to Build a Baseball Powerhouse. The author is Molly Knight, who has contributed to ESPN, the magazine, the New York Times magazine, and lots of other publications. Molly Knight, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So as we're recording this interview, the 2015 baseball season is in the home stretch, and the Dodgers are a couple of games in front of the Giants in first place in the National League West. And your book takes us right to the start of the 2015 season. So catch us up a little bit. What if you hadn't finished your book yet? What kinds of things would you be talking about? What's this season been like?
That's so funny. It's been a frustrating and weird season for the Dodgers. I say weird because there's this sense of, like, them being bad, even though they've been in first place for most of the year, because I think they've been underachieving. There have been injuries. There's been some sort of, like, uninspired play. The bullpen has been a mess. Puig is regressing. Jock Peterson started off amazing, and now he's looked pretty terrible at the plate for the last 2 months. So it's kind of a weird year, and I think that, honestly, ever since that 2013 year where they went 42-8, it's almost like ever since then it's been kind of a letdown, because that was like that was such amazing baseball being played that nothing can live up to that in a weird way. I think that fans don't realize that they're comparing it to that. I see a complaint from Dodger fans every day, and it's like, this team's been in first place all year long, and they currently have, like, the best World Series odds of any team, according to FanGraphs. Like, get a grip, people. But I understand.
Well, when you say you understand, because you're, in addition to being someone who has chronicled the team, you're a fan.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's just, you can just get a sense when teams are underachieving, it just kind of leaves a bad taste in your mouth, even if they are in first place. I just think there just been some things where it's like, I think just seeing, like I said, seeing Puig's regression and Jock's regression and the bullpen being terrible, it just really brings back horrible memories from last year. And I think there's also just this sense, and I think this is what Clayton Kershaw was dealing with earlier this year when he was not pitching like himself. I just think that there's this frustration the way they've gone out the last 2 years in the playoffs. There's this frustration of, like, none of this matters anyway. Let's just wait till October. Like, can it be October already? And the sense of, like, it's a what if they're in first place in the division? It's a waste if they don't make the World Series. So I think that there's a little bit of that frustration, a little bit of playoff hangover, and hopefully they can do something in the playoffs this year, because I don't want to write the same story again in the update for the paperback.
Well, you know, that's really interesting because, I know you've talked about this with other interviewers about how this book is kind of the other side of Moneyball and the sabermetrics crowd who, want to spend as little money as possible. And here's a team that was spending as much money as possible. And yet both books have the same ending, that is, neither team gets to the World Series and neither team wins the World Series.
Yeah, no, it's hard. It's really, really hard. I mean, I think that baseball is a really what makes it the best. My favorite sport is also what makes it the worst, which is that there's a sense of, like, there's a lot of randomness involved. There's a lot of, like, I don't think the team that wins at the end is the best team. I think they're the hottest team at that point. A pitcher just takes over, like what happened with the Giants last year with Bumgarner just being absolutely phenomenal. It's a weird, cruel thing that you can't really control. Unlike in the NBA, where it's like, well, we kind of have an idea, right? Like, pretty early on in the season, the four or five teams that could possibly win the championship. And in baseball, you don't know. I mean, gee, look at the Royals. Look at the Astros. I mean, they were 100-1 shots coming into the season to win the World Series, and it looks like they're going to win the AL West, which is not thought to be a slouch division. So it's a crazy sport, but that's, I think, what makes it so fun.
Do you think that there's an intangible that you can't calculate?
Yeah, it's. I wish that I knew what won championships. It's funny because I was
I mean, I'm new school. I'm nerdy. I'm really into the number stuff and the advanced stats stuff. I think it's really smart. And I was very much like failing against the whole chemistry argument or the whole like intangible, like champion will to win stuff. And for the most part, I still think that that's pretty bunk. Like, I'd rather have a bunch of really talented guys who are phenomenal, you know, and wins above replacement and all that, than a bunch of scrappy guys who get along who aren't that good. But that being said, like, being around, like, well, the Giants are a perfect example of this. They, in October, the way they play seems to translate in October. Same for the Royals. They've got really good defense. They've got phenomenal relief. Last year they had great pitching, relief pitching, and then, of course, Bumgarner. And they don't seem to give away at bats. They seem to all, they don't take any selfish at bats. Same with the Cardinals. What I mean by that is, you know, if the situation doesn't call, you don't always have to be trying to hit a home run. And I think when guys do that, they strike out more often than not. And there are a lot of Dodgers who do that and or who won't take walks because they think it's their job to drive in runs. And it's frustrating. And I think that I don't want to say I hate the term, like, play the game the right way, because I think that when people hear that, they just roll their eyes like, okay, come on, whatever. I think it's more of just like putting together really tough at bats. Like, they might not be the best player in the world, but they're up there and they're fouling off pitches and they're fouling off pitches and they're fouling off pitches and they're just trying to do something. And I think in the playoffs, that's really, really important when you only get 27 outs and the games are managed much tighter. I think it's much more important, and that's part of the Giant success.
Right. I mean, every at bat is crucial.
Yeah, yeah, and I think that they've done, I think part of the reason why they've had so much success with guys like Joe Panik and Matt Duffy and Brandon Crawford, I mean, these guys, they were groomed in the system, they've played together, they trust each other, and they, I think, I mean, as much as I want to say the chemistry arguments are overblown, it's like, there's something to be said for that trust, for lining up in the infield with guys who you've known for a long time, and guys who you fight for, and guys who you're willing to set, you're willing to hit the ball to the right side to advance a runner, to give the guy behind you a chance to knock the guy in. I mean, I know that's cliche, but I've seen it with my own eyes. I've seen what happens with Dodger players when they don't do that, and it's not good. So yeah, the Giants are much better at that.
Well, you know, in the era before this free agency and all this money, you know, teams stayed together for years and years and years, the exact team, the same lineup for you know, 10 years, 15 years. And those in those days, there was just as many different teams winning. I mean, there weren't quite as many teams as there are now, but,
right,
you know, one year the Cleveland Indians won, and one year the Yankees won, and one year the,
right,
you know, whatever. One year the Dodgers won, even, in 1955.
You can control, what I believe is with money, you can control, pretty much for the most part, the Dodgers can control making the playoffs for every year, or for like five out of every 6 years. Of course, there could be a year where like everybody gets hurt or whatever happens, disaster happens, like with the Red Sox this year. I don't know what happened to them, but you know, pretty much they can control making it every year. But then once you get in, you've got to have a team that's built for October. You've got to have a phenomenal bullpen. You've got to have good defense. You've got to just prevent as few runs as possible. And it's just a different game. And I think that it feels like a little fluky that the Giants and the Royals made the World Series last year when they weren't the best teams. But they were, the way that they played, I think, was the most suited toward October. And I don't know. I think that, I don't know if it's so much heart as it is just like I said, the defense and the bullpen and the tough at bats. I mean, I guess they could all fall into the category of heart, but there's also skill involved there too.
Sure. But I mean, I guess it's easy to like each other when you're on the team and you're winning, and it must be much harder
exactly.
to like each other when you're blowing
exactly.
it.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's sort of like what the whole argument is, like what comes first, the winning or the chemistry? Because I was, you know, on the Dodgers team in 2013 when they were terrible and they were not getting along. They all hate each other and were snapping at each other and all that. And then they went on that crazy run when they went 42-8, and then, you know, and they were getting along. And yeah, some guys were still frustrated with Puig and with different things that were happening, but it wasn't that big of a deal. And I think Puig is a great example of this, where he's been basically behaving the same way for 3 years, but he was, before, his OPS was over 900. So it's like, you can kind of get away with whatever you want when you're that good. But when you start sort of like coming back to earth and playing like an average player, then no, you can't you can't have that superstar ego and, like, you know, all these concessions being made for, like, different rules, you know? And so that's sort of like what the difference is. Like, you can behave a certain way if you're winning and you're hitting and you're one of the best players in the world.
Right. Yeah. We're talking baseball with Molly Knight, and her book is called The Best Team Money Can Buy: The Los Angeles Dodgers' Wild Struggle to Build a Baseball Powerhouse. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. Your book has this incredible cast of characters, almost like a novel. Can you see a movie? They're going to make a movie out of your book?
Oh, I mean, I think that's the reason people say, are you going to write another baseball book? And not that I would say no to that, like, unequivocally, but this book worked for me because of the characters. I really felt like it was a book about people. You had such compelling, weird, heartbreaking, crazy people in the same room that it was more just like they happen to play baseball. You get like a Clayton Kershaw, Zach Greinke, a Matt Kemp, a Hanley Ramirez, a Yasiel Puig, Magic Johnson, Don Mattingly. I mean, these are all really, really rich characters. And yeah, I mean, I don't know if it would be made into a movie. I didn't think Moneyball was going to be made into a movie that worked, and they did a phenomenal job with that. So I don't know. I would be open to it. Maybe listening to it and wants to turn it into a movie, you know, find me on the internet.
Well, you are in Los Angeles.
I feel like every studio head is like a big Dodger fan, so I'm hoping one of them will read this and just be like, yes.
I want to ask you about the money aspect of things, because since the word money is in the title of your book, and
right.
And the vast sums of money are really, you know, startling. And
yeah.
a lot of fans are really turned off by all the money. I hear this all the time. I'm sure you do too. Like, oh, he makes so much. And
I
understand that they, you know, they generate, you know, I'm a teacher, so I make very little money. But I mean, we don't generate any money, and they do. They generate money. They get the fans to come in and they get the television contracts and all that stuff. And so I guess they're entitled to whatever money they make. But still, these vast sums of money really can be a turnoff. You know, like going to the ballpark, it could cost, you know, what? I mean,
a lot of money. It's true.
It's not $12. It's, you know, $200.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, I'm totally sensitive to that. It's a weird thing where, like, on the one hand, yeah, I get it. Like, especially when players are like, oh, my toe hurts, I don't want to play today, and they're making $20 million. Like, get it together. But on the other hand, I'm also just like, you want to be kind of mad, like, or point look at the Dodgers and be like, oh my gosh, their payroll this year is over $300 million. Well, part of that is because this new ownership group had to cut bait with a lot of bad signings this new front office had to cut bait with a lot of bad signings that the old front office did. So I feel like $80 million of that money is like being paid to people like Brian Wilson, Brandon League, like people who are no longer on the team anymore.
Brian Wilson gets paid a ton of money to not play. See, now I would
$10 million.
I would be willing to not play for a lot less. They could get it.
I know. Me too. Trust me. Me too. And you know, it's because they wanted to be rid of him because he was, you know, a mess. Or Brandon League, who was a nice enough guy, but just, you know, was not very good anymore. Players like that. And I think that, that it's easy to get upset. And I understand, because it almost feels like, in a way, it's like, it almost feels like as a fan, it feels like it's your money. Because, you know, you're the one going to the game, spending the money, and it's like, it feels like it's your money to, like, that's going into their pockets. And so you just feel like it's ridiculous what they're making, or like that you're overspending on the wrong people. But it's like it's easy to forget that it's like, it's the ownership group's money, you know, like it's, they're the ones who are spending buying the players and doing all that. And I think that, I don't know. I'd rather have I guess for me, cause I'm like pro labor person, I'd rather have like the players making that money than the owners who rake in all the money from fans and don't spend it on players. I feel like I'm more in favor of that. If those are our two alternatives, you know,
right.
Of course, it'd be nice if like they just, if each player just sort of like, you know, took a hot dog gun. What are those things that fire t-shirts in the crowd and just like fired money into the crowd?
Wouldn't that be nice? Well,
yeah.
It could be kind of volatile since the fans Well, I mean,
yes, everywhere. I don't recommend making it rain in a stadium. That would be pretty crazy. But I don't know, maybe like a nice little surprise for under each seat or something. I don't know.
Yeah. Or a $10 game or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, the Dodgers have done. I've got to say, I've been AT&T Park is a lot more expensive than Dodger Stadium. I went to Stanford actually, and when I was there 10 years ago. We went to a lot of A's games because we couldn't afford to go to AT&T Park. It was way too expensive. We go to Dollar Wednesdays, and that was so fun. And Dodger Stadium, they have cheap enough seats. Like, you can go, you can get season tickets to Dodger Stadium for like under $10 if you want.
But there's a lot of smog between you and the field.
No, actually, it's pretty good based on pretty good value depending on where you are. I found that, I mean, it's also just a reflection of the Bay Area right now and cost of living and everything just being out of control. But with all the tech money, Dodger games are way more affordable than Giants games, unfortunately for Bay Area fans, but there's always the A's. So, you know,
that's true.
Support the A's.
Well, we're talking with Molly Knight, and her book is called The Best Team Money Can Buy: The Los Angeles Dodgers Wild Struggle to Build a Baseball Powerhouse. It's a great book. I love your book. You were just talking earlier about would you write another baseball book? I mean, what other things what other things do you write about? What other things interest you?
Well, this is my first book, so it was funny. I was just trying to get through it, honestly. I only had I had about a year writing it and editing it and fact checking it and copying it, which is insane for a book. And so for me, I was just like focused. I was so exhausted and focused on getting it done that I was like, oh, I don't even know if I'm going to write a book again or if anyone's going to read this or if people are liking it or whatever. And the feedback has been so, and the support has been so overwhelming and amazing that I'm like, well, maybe I should write another one if people would want me to. But I don't know. If I were to write a baseball book, I spent a lot of time in Houston with the Astros front office when they were blowing everything up and starting over. That interests me. I don't know that I would want to move to Houston for 2 years, which I would have to do. It's really hot there and it's really humid. And that's not really my scene politically either. But it's a nice town. I mean, I have friends there and the food's really good. They have air conditioning in that ballpark, so that would work. I don't know. I was thinking about, like, it's funny. Someone asked me if I would write a book about A-Rod because he's so interesting, and I thought about that for a minute. Then I'm like, well, he's so hated, and like, I just don't know, like, if you could quote a guy like that because he lies so much, even if he's fascinating. I'm not sure. And then I don't know. I'm just kind of wondering. I don't know what I would do. I guess I got to come up with an idea before I start writing the next book. I'm not sure. It would be nonfiction. I don't really do fiction. Although I don't know if many authors. I think. Even fiction writers, unless they're writing about like intergalactic stuff, I think that it's mostly nonfiction. They just like change the names of people involved. I couldn't imagine like creating someone out of thin air and knowing them inside and out. Although I guess some people have more vivid imaginations than I do.
Well, you have a really nice style, a really nice voice in the books. So did you have some training as a writer?
No, I had no training ever, and I had no training as a journalist either. I guess just training would just be like regular school, like everyone else. I didn't go to journalism school. I never wrote for a school paper. I think I was just like, I don't know, I never thought it was any good or that there was like a possible career in it or something. So it just seemed like really scary to like write a short story or write like essays, personal essays, or whatever people do when they're young. In high school or college, so I just sort of taught myself, I guess. But I'm a pretty voracious reader, and so I think, you know, when you read a lot of like Joan Didion or Michael Lewis or Tom Wolfe or, you know, Gatelese or Faulkner or any of that stuff, like it rubs off.
I guess. I mean, hopefully.
Your relationship with the Dodgers is really kind of the heart of the book. Maybe that wouldn't happen if you tried to write a book about another team. I mean, you were a little girl.
No, you're exactly right. And people say, like, oh, you grew up a fan of this team. Does that make it weird? It's like, well, yeah, it did. But I think that most fans, it's weird. Like, I think that fans can be harder on the teams they love than anybody else. So, I mean, the way you see, I mean, I'm sure we all see this if we're on the internet. You see the way fans freak out. I think the sky is falling when the team's on like a 3-game losing streak, you know,
right.
And they're ready to fire everybody and, you know, get cut this player and trade this guy and what an idiot and everything's awful. I think my people were out here when the Dodgers moved from Brooklyn and they embraced the team like on day one. And, both my parents grew up going to games and, geez, my great grandmother was the one who took me to games when I was little. And so I think just having that sort of context, I don't think I could have written a book like this because it was really about a book about like how much the team is like meant to the city and how much it meant to, when the Dodgers came out west and the Dodgers and Giants came out to California. And like, that was like sort of like California was like kind of in its adolescence at that point. And I really feel that Major League Baseball, when the Giants and the Dodgers moved out here, it helped legitimize California as part of the rest of the country because now they're part of this like, you know, national organization, and it was a big deal. You had like superstars coming through town, and geez, like Ernie Banks and Ted Williams and everybody, you know, just coming around and. Maybe that's Ted Williams because he was on the Red Sox, but you know what I mean. Like you had these superstars, and I don't know. I just think it was really cool. And when McCourt came in and sort of ransacked this civic treasure, it was just it felt personal. Honestly, it felt like he was taking this thing that had been so important to my family, so many families, Evangelinos, and just spitting on it. And It sucks when that happens. And I think that fans of teams, especially if it runs generationally, I think it can be a really emotional thing. And it's weird how, and I felt this too, just in reporting this book, like I see a lot of these players come and go and I just realize like, you know, these guys are for the most part, they're mercenaries. I mean, some of them really care about winning just as a point of personal pride. They want to win a World Series. They want to have that ring and get all that. But for a lot of them, they come in here, they're just hired to do a job for a year, 2 years, 3 years, whatever, and then it's on to the next job, the next team. And so, like, you know, they're not going to be angsty for years and years and years over the Dodgers not winning a title. Like, whereas for fans, it's like this thing where, like, the fans are there forever. The players and the executives, they come and the owners, they come and go.
Right,
so it's really interesting to me to think, that, you know, in often cases, the fans want it more than the players themselves do.
Well, you don't think that they really want to win? I mean, they do want to win, of course.
No, they do. No. I'm not saying they don't, but it's just different when it's hard for me to expect it's hard for me to expect a guy who just got traded, you know, to the Dodgers like
2 days ago,
right? Uh-huh. Like having as much of a vested emotional and he's going to be a free agent after the season's over, right?
Right. It just
like
came in to do this thing.
Having as much of a vested emotional interest in the Dodgers winning their first World Series title in 27 years as somebody who has been a fan for that long, you know? Like, even if, and I don't blame them for it. It's
right.
Like,
sure.
You know, and I'm not saying that means they don't want to win, but it's just, they can tell themselves, okay, next year they go sign with the Cubs or the Red Sox or whatever, you know?
Yeah, no. Yeah, no, exactly what you mean.
They won't be disappointed in the moment if it doesn't happen, but it's just a different, I don't know, it's just a different thing.
Right, I mean, it's kind of like that for every good thing you get, you also get this equally bad thing. Like, it's much better, of course, for the players that they're not indentured servants like they were all through the kind of golden age of baseball. It was terrible for them. But at the same time, you did have that team camaraderie that now you would never have because of this you know, this thing that you're just talking about. You know, you got Uribe is a Giant. He goes to the World Series, and the next season he's a Dodger.
Right, and you know you got guys like Uribe, and it does not surprise me in the least that the Mets are like doing you know, what's the Mets record since Juan Uribe went over there? And not because I think Juan Uribe is winning every game for them, but it just seems like he always finds a way to be, like, on a relevant team. I mean, he went to the White Sox, and they won to the Giants, and then they won to the Dodgers, and then, like, you know, they've been good. They didn't win the World Series, but they've been in the mix. Now he's, like, goes to the Mets, and all of a sudden they're relevant again. It's like, he's always, I don't know, the people like that, success just sort of, like, follows around because of the energy they bring. He's totally going to hit a home run that, like, the Dodgers over, just watch. I don't know how it's going to happen. I don't know if it's going to be in a game against the Dodgers or what it's going to be, but you just watch. Something's going to happen, and it's going to be like backfire city. There's just something about that guy. I've never been around a player, and I mentioned this in the book. It's so impressive to me because I think what I didn't realize when I walked into the first clubhouse I walked into, I didn't realize, like, how segregated players are based on the language they speak, which makes sense, like, obviously, like, duh. But, you know, they all seem to get along on the field and joke around and stuff, so you just don't realize. You walk into a locker room, and it's just, like, there's, like, a line drawn down the middle. It's the English-speaking players who talk to each other and the Spanish-speaking players who talk to each other. And it's just, like, it's just so, it was so jarring for me to realize, like, oh, yeah, like, that makes sense, because even if I spoke, you know, decent enough Spanish, I would want to, like, be speaking English and joking with people who I could feel like I could make a joke in the language, you know, my native language. Like, I get it. I get why the Spanish-speaking players are more comfortable with each other. And Juan Uribe is the only player I've ever seen who is friends with every single person on a team, regardless of what language they speak, what position they play, their status in the league, whether they're a rookie who just got called up today, a journeyman who's, like, on unsteady footing, a relief pitcher, you know, whatever it is, he's your friend. And there's just, like, that's such a rare person who has that knack that I would, like, put him on my team no matter what. Like, if I was starting a team, like, he would be, like, one of the first people that I hired.
So you believe in the intangibles after all?
I believe that he's a special case. I believe that if you can have a guy, like, case for instance, when Hyunjin Ryu, Dodgers brought Hyunjin Ryu over from Korea and they signed him, he's just, you know, he's 25 years old, good kid, all this, doesn't speak a lick of English or Spanish for that matter, has no way to communicate with anybody, and is just like, and is living like thousands of miles away from everybody he knows. Okay. So Juan Uribe just, like, senses that Rue basically, like, has no one to eat meals with or talk to, and he just, like, tackles him, like, and starts wrestling with him. Doesn't know how to talk to him, but just was like, we're going to do this, and then just, like, starts playing dominoes with him, starts playing cards with him, and then they're inseparable. And Rue told me at the end of that season that he had been homesick, he had been worried about how to make friends. I mean, not, like, to the point where he was going to leave or anything, but who knows how the season would have gone for him if he hadn't felt a part of the team. And he was great. He was a huge, you know, a huge reason why they went to the NLCS and made it closer to the World Series than they had in 25 years. And Juan Uribe was the one that brought him into the fold. And there are things like that that, you know, fans don't see that or don't really know about that are huge. And the Giants have done a really great job, I think, Well, the Giants have Buster Posey as the leader. And the Dodgers, they don't have a starting player right now, with the exception of maybe Jimmy Rollins, but he's new, a starting position player who's a real leader. So the Cardinals and the Giants have that with Molina and Posey. And I don't think that's a coincidence that those two teams keep making the World Series every year for that very reason.
The book is called The Best Team Money Can Buy, The Dodgers' Wild Struggle to Build a Baseball Powerhouse. The author is Molly Knight. Thank you so much for spending some time talking to us on From the Bookshelf.
Okay, thank you so much.
Well, that's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Molly Knight. Her book is called The Best Team Money Can Buy, the Los Angeles Dodgers' wild struggle to build a baseball powerhouse. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.